Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I will be reading for you today World Radio Online. You're on the Care Jandy AM system. World Radio is published monthly by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Nancy Cott, WZHC. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today in the World Radio Online Newsfront. Congressional bill to reform regulatory matters is introduced. A bill to change the way that the Federal Communications Commission approaches all regulatory matters has been introduced in the United States House of Representatives. Sponsored by Representatives Joe Burton of Texas and Cliff Stearns of Florida, H.R. 2183, seeks to reform some of the Federal Communication Commission's regulatory processes. Among the matters that H.R. 2183 addresses is a requirement that would force the FCC to let the public see any and all proposed rule and rule changes before it adopts them. Also, that the agency would be forced to provide everyone with a realistic amount of time to comment. The measure would require the FCC to provide at least 30 days for comments and an additional 30 days for replies on the published language of proposed rules. The measure would also give the FCC only 30 days from adoption of a policy to release the actual text of the decision. According to the wording of the bill, Representatives Barton and Stearns want to require the agency to publish weekly the items being circulated among the commissioners for a vote. They also want to name any commissioner who has not voted on a given term. For ham radio, which would mean knowing more about what changes are being considered for our service instead of having to second guess what the future might bring. That was furnished by Newsline. The current IRCs expire at the end of the year. The current IRCs will expire at the end of the year. Like the old-style coupons, the current types all have an expiration date giving them a maximum life of 3 years. Even if you purchased a current IRC today, they will still expire on December 31st, 2009. Amateur call ZL2HU advises us on the following information from the International Postal Union in Geneva. Quoting, the current issue, which is Beijing 2, IRC, may be exchanged up to 31 December 2009, date printed on the coupon. In principle, Beijing 2 coupons will no longer be sold from 31 August 2009. Quoting again, the new international reply coupon, Nairobi model, is due to go on sale from 1 July 2009 and will be valid for exchange until 31 December 2013. So make sure you aren't holding any of the Beijing 2 coupons at the end of this year. Our next news front piece, Congress looks at MCOM response measure. Congress is taking a look at the valuable role that ham radio plays in times of natural or man-made disasters. This after U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas has introduced H.R. 2160 in the U.S. House of Representatives. Better known as the Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enhancement Act of 2009, H.R. 2160 would promote and encourage the valuable public service, disaster relief, and emergency communications provided on a volunteer basis by licensees of the amateur radio service. By undertaking a study of the uses of amateur radio for emergency and disaster relief communications, the study would also identify unnecessary or unreasonable impediments to the deployment of amateur radio emergency and disaster relief communications. It would also make recommendations for relief of any such unreasonable restrictions, so as to expand the uses of amateur radio communications in homeland security planning and response. H.R. 2160 has been referred to the Committee on Energy and Commerce. If enacted into law, the measure would instruct the Secretary of Homeland Security to undertake its own study and report its findings to Congress within 180 days. That study would also spell out the capabilities and specific uses of amateur radio communications in emergencies and disaster relief situations. That was contributed by ARRL Newsline. Nielsen says Twitter has more quitters than joiners. Ham radio is nothing to fear from the Twitter instant messaging social network. A Nielsen online survey that found the number of people leaving Twitter after just 1 month outnumbered the new arrivals by a margin of 3-2-2. David Martin is Nielsen's vice president of primary research. He says that if Twitter's user retention rates don't do better than the current 40%, the service simply won't be able to grow into the internet social networking giants such as MySpace and Facebook. According to Nielsen, in March, Facebook saw 69.2 million unique users, representing 41% of the U.S. web audience. MySpace at 55.9 million, or 33%. Despite its initial rapid growth, Twitter lagged far behind at 13.9 million users and 8.2%. No reason was given to explain the massive defection from Twitter. But Nielsen's Martin says that if 60% continue to quit from 1 month to the next, the inability to replace defectors suggests a natural limit to growth with Twitter. He expects for it to max out at about 10% of the U.S. internet audience. As to ham radio, while nobody does regular research on the retention rate in the hobby, it appears to be well above 85% to 90% month by month. We thank R.W., Chicago Tribune, and others for that information. Packeteers to hold Golden Pack event. Packet operators and VHF rover stations will attempt the first ever Appalachian Trail Golden Packet event on Sunday, July 26. The goal is to relay packet text messages the full 2,000-mile length of the Appalachian Trail using 14 packet relay stations carried to the tops of some of the highest peaks in the eastern United States. This long, linear demonstration will hopefully show the power of packet radio to reconstitute emergency communications into an area where normal communications capabilities can easily be lost. It will also demonstrate how easy a ham radio data network can be established using nothing more than a typical APRS mobile radio installation that's driven to the highest available spot in any given area. More information about the Appalachian Trail Golden Packet event is online at www.aprs.org. We furnish radio call sign WB4APR for that information. One more online piece, Honolulu Hams win mobile radio exemption. A major victory for hams in Honolulu, Hawaii. Bill 4, the pro-ham radio mobile cellular phone legislation for the city and county of Honolulu, passed third reading on April 22nd and has passed out to the council. The measure includes a full exemption for radio amateurs from the effects of this bill. This bill is significant because it addresses the issue of traffic safety, but does not diminish the role of amateur radio in the course of the legislation. It's also believed to be the first legislation in Hawaii that fully supports amateur radio. The mayor will sign this bill into law shortly, with an effective date to be July 1st. But the fight is not over yet. The Hawaii County Council is currently working on a draft equivalent to Bill 4, but so far lacks the exemption of amateur radio. According to Ron Hashiro, AH6RH, the next few weeks will be important for the Big Island for testimony and education of their council members. That information was filed by AH6R and KH6QX. It's time to go now to the editor's log. Our editor, Nancy Cott. Nancy spells the last name K-O-T-T. Her call, W-Z-H-C, Whiskey, Zulu, 8, Charlie. Many people will agree that amateur radio operators enjoy chatting on the air more than they like to socialize in person. But there is no denying that spring, particularly April, May, and June, is our social season. There are opportunities across the country to get together with our own kind and recharge our enthusiasm for the upcoming summer. We come out of hibernation by the thousands, have eyeball CUSOs with buddies we haven't seen since last year, then retreat into our shacks for a summer of hammy. It starts with the Visalia DX convention in April, continues with the Dayton Hamvention in May, June brings the Texas HamCom. The social season culminates with Field Day, the last full weekend in June. I would like to thank the folks who stopped by the QC Communications booth and the FIST booth at the Hamvention to give their opinion on the new World Radio Online. At the CQ Communications booth, the monitor scrolled through an issue of WRO. We were able to show many people how to find the WRO website and download it or read it online. We received many compliments on how terrific the magazine looks in color, and everyone I spoke with was pleased that we hadn't changed its content and focus. A concern we were able to address was, what happened to my lifetime WR subscription? If you didn't see the announcements and information in World Radio or CQ magazines, and didn't inform the CQ staff of your preference, the amount you paid for your lifetime subscription was automatically converted over to the equivalent in CQ magazine issues. For example, if you spent $90 for your lifetime subscription 20 years ago, then that $90 was converted into CQ issues, which would be almost 2.5 years' worth of CQ. If you pay $250 for your lifetime WR subscription, then you'd receive $250 worth of CQ. If you would like to change the magazine you're receiving, you have your choice between CQ, CQVHF, and Popular Communications. Simply let the subscription folks at CQ Communications know, and you can change it to another magazine. We want to keep you happy, as well as keep you as a WRO listener. Is your local radio club promoting ham radio during Field Day? I hope you will take photos and enter our Gold Megaphone Award Contest. As you may have already noticed, we've added a permanent Gold Megaphone Award Contest information link to the WRO welcoming page. Now you can view complete contest information and download or print an application form in PDF at any time. A note on the June issue. Our apologies to John Johnston, W3BE, and any readers who may have been confused by an item in John's June Rules and Regs column. A question was inadvertently omitted, making the answer appear to be a response to a previous question. The correct third question in the column should read, now here we pose the question. A friend offered to let me put his repeater on the air with his call sign and be the SCO. I contend that the ID should be my call sign or the call sign of the club station for which that I am the trustee. Which is correct? And the answer, either arrangement that you both can mutually agree upon. For your station call sign to be transmitted in the station identification announcement, he must relinquish to you physical control of his station apparatus. And there's a reference to Section 97.5, Sub A. And then followed the next question, what about the propriety of a club having a pair of 2-meter repeaters transmitting simultaneously? And with that, Nancy ends her commentary in the editor's log with Happy Independence Day and hope to hear you on the air. 73-88-33. Nancy Cott, WC8C. Now for the listener, if you'd like to email Nancy Cott, it should go to World Radio Editor, that's lowercase, one word, World Radio Editor at cq-amateur-radio.com. Well, we'll go now to FM, VHF, and repeaters column, titled Looking West, What Would You Do? The author, Bill Pasternak, called WA6ITF. What would you do if you received a repeater channel pair on 2 meters from your local coordinator, then spent your hard-earned money to put a machine on the air, only to have the council tell you to take it off the air because the former owner of a repeater that used to operate on that channel wanted it back? This situation happens far more often than you might want to believe. Last March, a contributor to eham.net posted the following, paraphrased, "Recently, my friend and I decided to put up a repeater. We made a list of unused repeater pairs within 80 miles of us from the Repeater Council's database. We applied for 145.39, permission was granted, and we started using repeater on this pair. Sometime later, another repeater began operation on the frequency. It turns out the owner is a coordinator and was threatening to sue the Repeater Council for giving his frequency pair away after he had let his coordination lapse past the grace period. 11 months later, my friend, whose call was used for our repeater, was notified that his coordination had been revoked and we were to stop using this pair immediately. There was no reason given. This is in strict violation of their bylaws and rules and regulations. What would you do?" So now Bill Pasternak picks up his comments. Titled, "To coordinate means only to recommend." The term coordinate has a finite meaning in relation to amateur radio repeaters. In ham radio, coordinate is used as a verb, and it means to arrange in proper order or position and or to combine in harmonious relation or action. A coordinator or a coordination council is nothing more than an individual or body of individuals who use their technical expertise to combine the various interests in a given spectral parcel to permit all wishing to use that space to do so in a harmonious relationship to one another. All a coordinator can do is to recommend frequencies that give a prospective repeater a reasonable chance of success with minimal impact on those others in the same geographic area. The FCC does not require amateur repeaters to be coordinated, and a coordinator may not force anyone to stop using a given frequency pair. Only the FCC can do that. The FCC recommends coordination and will give precedence to a coordinated repeater in the event of a dispute between repeaters if one is coordinated and the other isn't. If both are coordinated, they are both equally responsible for working things out. But there is an obvious problem. What are the minimum standards that all coordinators or coordination bodies must adhere to? You know, inter-system geographic spacing. Use of tertiary 15 kilohertz channels on 2 meters. The simple answer is that there is no one universal national standard of coordination or even a universal minimum standard to consider an applicant for coordination's needs. In the earliest days of the second wave, coordination effort started about 1972 and continuing to about 1980, there was some amount of concern on this issue. Eventually, there was a handshake agreement that the nation would go along with standards and the band plan developed by the Texas VHF FM Society in the late 1960s. Even the ARRL got in on the act and declared it the officially anointed plan, and the Texas plan based on 60 kilohertz inter-system spacing and the 600 kilohertz input-to-output separation was the de facto standard in many places. A few years later, the 60 kilohertz channel spacing was cut in half to 30 kilohertz, and even later to 15 kilohertz. The only problem was that the political leadership in some geographic areas did not want to give up their autonomy and political acumen for a one-size-fits-all national plan. In the end, we wound up with a plethora of band plans on 2 meters, where some regions used the 15 kilohertz channels upright. Other regions inverted them. Still others abandoned 30 and 15 in favor of 20 kilohertz. Likewise, on 70 centimeters, the repeater spacing began at 50 kilohertz. Later, it became 25 kilohertz. Then, a few years ago, as space ran out for new repeaters, a few places split to 12.5 kilohertz, the commercial standard, while others opted to go 20 kilohertz and re-coordinate the entire repeater subband. At this point, please permit me to digress and note that as one who served with a number of repeater coordination efforts on two coasts, coordination is as much, quoting, political as it is, quoting, technological. Dealing with the problem of the non-existent or so-called paper repeater is one of them. No frequency is worth fighting over. In this author's views, no frequency or repeater pair is worth fighting over. In the end, even the one who wins the fight also loses because the anti-air range war will have left a proverbial bad taste in the mouths of many who wanted no part of the mess, but were drawn into it peripherally. Also, the variable here is not the political power, or lack of power, on the part of the coordinator. He has done his job. At this point, the coordinator likely has no other obligation to either repeater. In reality, the decision is up to the person wanting to maintain the new repeater as to whether it is worth the price of a range war between his repeater and the inactive one that suddenly sprang back to life and wants the new kid on the block to go off the air. Also, the question must be asked as to whether it is worth the risk of litigation that might ensue. And is it worth either or both of you risking a citation or a possible fine from the FCC over this matter? Nevertheless, one thing is obvious to this writer. I have said it before, and I'll say it here again. Had the implementation of universal and rigid standards for coordination been successful in 1968, many of today's problems would never have come to pass. In the end, you have to consider the legal definition of the word coordinate and coordinator to understand the actual extent of a coordinator's power, which these days is vested with the overall area ham radio community. When a coordinator fails the needs, wants, and desires of the local community it serves, that coordinator will be replaced. It is very easy for folks, especially those outside your area and who have never owned nor operated a repeater, to opine. But in the end, it is you, not they, who must deal with the reality of the situation, and it is your license that is on the line, not theirs. And one last word on those ham versus ham lawsuits. As to one ham suing for not being able to hold on to repeater coordination, or for other repeater-related situations, it seems to be an unfortunate part of today's ham radio landscape. It has happened many times in the past. I guess the first such case was circa 1968 or 1969 on a repeater in northern New Jersey. While in that case, the matter never went to trial, the litigant did get a substantial but undisclosed cash settlement from the three hams whom he accused of jamming his call and from the club that owned the repeater for, quoting, permitting him to be jammed. Since it was an out-of-court settlement, it never became cash law. Since then, there have been at least a dozen such cases I know of, some well covered in past columns. I recall one from a few years back, a radio club hiring an attorney to get a civil restraining order against three people harassing the club repeater. Then the three, quoting, unwanted, got their own lawyer to countersue. That was mid-1990. The club was successful and got the order, but the situation then escalated as others created a melee of jamming in support of those run off the machine. While each side of this dispute claimed victory, the only real winners were the lawyers representing their clients. It is a strange but true fact that people sue people every day because it has become the in thing to do in today's ultra-litigious society. Be it over the shade of one's shirt, the height of long grass, how warm or cold a cup of coffee is, or even the way you sound on the air, some pretty stupid nuisance lawsuits are filed. Added to this is the fact that there exists some bottom-feeding lawyers out to make a name for themselves who will do anything to convince you to file a lawsuit so that they can gain a bit of fame, notoriety, and your life savings in payment. However, you cannot go through life hiding in a cocoon. Life is filled with both the good and the bad. All we can do is try to walk softly while being prepared. Besides which, there might be a neighbor who sues you because he or she is allergic to your cocoon. Well, folks, there you have Bill Pasternak's commentary in FM, VHF, and three repeaters in the July World Radio Online issue. Well, I think I'll change gears now and go to Youth Forum, the Liberty Science Center. The author here is Carol Perry, WB2MGP. After almost 30 years of teaching Introduction to Amateur Radio to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders in a New York City intermediate school, I learned the lesson of incorporating as much hands-on learning into the curriculum as possible. There's no doubt that youngsters learn better when they are actively involved with the education process. Although the ham radio program lent itself to bringing in interesting guest speakers, making exciting contacts on the air, and doing experiments in the classroom, nothing was more stimulating than going on a field trip. One of the most successful trips we took was to the Liberty Science Center in Liberty State Park in Jersey City, New Jersey. Through the years, my classes have visited several local discovery museums and communication sites, like the Ben Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, the New York City Police Academy Communications Center, and the Coast Guard Station on Governor's Island. Years ago, when I visited these places with my classes, there was always something going on, either with a ham radio operator or a radio demonstration. Well, now the ham stations are no longer in many of these locations. At several local museums that used to house wonderful stations for the children to interact with, such as the Queens Hall of Science ARC station, WB2JSM, ham groups were told by new administrators that the lack of interest in this type of exhibit no longer warranted space in the museum. One has to wonder how many children's lives were influenced through the years by their fun exposures to live radio contacts. Now, in my retirement years and as co-chair of the Radio Club of America Education Committee, I'm interested in seeking out logical places to prominently display ham stations. I recently took my two young granddaughters to the Liberty Science Center, where I met with Elizabeth Romano, who explained the new $109 million expansion to me. The center is the New Jersey, New York City region's largest educational resource. It is dedicated to providing transformative experiences that connect schools and society with science and technology. The center uses unique approaches to engaging people of all ages in a real science to positively influence communities and societies and inspire them to take action to improve our world. Once largely aimed at children aged 6 to 12, exhibits now include experiences to appeal to every age and stage of learning. We were, of course, disappointed to learn that there's no longer a ham radio station there. Evidently, lack of interest seems to be the recurring theme. I personally do not believe this. What could be more fun for a youngster than to get on a microphone and talk for the first time? We really need to examine what the problem is at these venues. I'll be investigating at more locations to see if I can come up with some relevant facts and suggestions on how we can increase our visibility to the public. While at this state-of-the-art facility, we did explore the communications and the I Explore exhibits. My granddaughter loved trying to speak a new language at the Language Karate exhibit. Then they created a digital tag at the 10-foot-long graffiti wall. There were interesting displays showing how humans have exchanged ideas over the millennia, from simple handprints to complex ink and knotted messages to today's digital pathways. There is a 7,000-square-foot exhibit that explores human communication from a cultural perspective. Here, guests explored not only how we communicate with multimedia and personal communications devices, but also with our bodies, spoken and written language, and symbolism. Certainly anyone teaching a ham radio or a technology course to children will derive tremendous benefits from taking classes to this exhibit. At the entrance to the exhibition, guests discover one of the first recorded symbols in human communications, the handprint. Guests can leave their own digital handprint as they mark the beginning of their journey through the exhibit. Throughout the zone, experiences lay the groundwork for guests to understand the fundamental impact of communications on our lives. I Explore is a 4,000-square-foot exhibition designed to nurture children's innate curiosity about the world surrounding them, expanding their natural desire to learn. Some of the activities here include making music on the rock xylophone, hanging rock slabs that ring when struck, which teaches children about cause and effect, the properties of sound, and some surprising characteristics possessed by certain kinds of rocks. Youngsters also get to experiment with gravity, momentum, and other forces. If you live in the New Jersey, New York City area, I absolutely recommend the LSC as a wonderfully engaging place to take children. If you do go there, be sure to make a statement before you leave about the enrichment that a ham radio station could provide to these exhibits. For more information, you could visit online www.lsc.org to learn more. If any of my readers know of a location where there's an active ham radio station designed to attract kids, please let me know. I just might jump on a plane to see it for myself. Let's keep having fun. Well, there's Youth Forum for this month. We thank Carol Perry, WB2MGP, for her comments about the Library Science Center. Well, let's take a look at the Quarter Century Wireless Association, QCWA. QCWA Leadership, an Analogy. Author, Alan Pickering, call KJ9N, Kilo Juliet 9, November. By assignment from others, I am the net control station, called Master Oscillator, for a weekly net that is named the Knights and Ladies of the Kilocycle. We believe that it is the longest continuously running net in the United States of America, perhaps even the world, inasmuch as it was founded on Christmas Day in 1929 and has operated every week since, except during the days of World War II. And by coincidence, those facts reminded me of the longest continuously run race in the world, the Oxford and Cambridge boat rowing race that was first begun in March 100 years earlier. In 1829, when the best athletes from Great Britain's two oldest universities met on the ice-encrusted Thames in London to determine which one of the two might prevail in a boat race between the two. A close examination of this annual boat race between Oxford and Cambridge has enough parallels to the leadership of QCWA chapters to speculate upon the characteristics thereof and to draw an analogy that QCWA chapters and their officers should find worth considering. Remember that in 1829, the British Empire truly spanned the globe, and as the English liked to brag at that time, that the sun never set upon their nation nor its colonies. Furthermore, who could doubt that in 1823, the finest minds and intellects of the Western world were collected together in the facilities and classrooms of the colleges making up Oxford and Cambridge universities? They had it all, the brightest and the best from the chin up. But unknown in 1829 was which of the two institutions had the best athletes, the strongest muscles, the greatest stamina, the finer teamwork, in the associated disciplines of physical training from the chin down? That was the question. So, the first Oxford versus Cambridge sculling boat race competition was organized to find out. The contest would test the athletes in the most rigorous sport common to the gentlemen attending the two universities. Rowing at Long Ben, recognized as one of the more important institutional sports approved by those who managed and directed the Olympic races. But this particular race would determine which of the two leading universities in the Western world might at that time be the better for sports activities. The dedication and the fitness of the teams representing the two schools would thereby be demonstrated for the whole world to see. It is a matter of fact that collegiate-level rowing requires absolutely precise teamwork. If the eight rowers see that the oars cannot perfectly synchronize their rowing strokes so that their oars enter and leave the water exactly in unison, pulling the boat down the race course effectively will not happen. Perfect harmony between each rower is an absolute requirement, no matter how strong or how fit each individual might be. Chaos, broken equipment, and even capsizing are risks that must be overcome by exacting teamwork. Keeping those eight rowers together in perfect synchronicity while guiding the boat down the river from start to finish by the shortest possible route is the job of the ninth member of the crew, their leader, the coxswain. The coxswain does not row, not even a little bit, but the rowing crew cannot win without an expert coxswain sitting in the stern of the boat. The coxswain is responsible for shouting encouragement to the oarsmen, maintaining the rowing tempo, and guiding the scull down the race course through the swirls and eddies and flotsam floating in the river. Sculling coxswains on the Thames all know that any boat on that river must aim for the second lamppost from the left, which marks the deepest portion of the river and thus most likely to represent the fastest flow of water and thus the best place to be when passing Hammersmith Bridge. Statistically, 85% of the time, the winner is the boat whose coxswain follows that rule. Now it's time for my analogy. Just like a sculling crew that is racing on the Thames at London, every QCWA chapter should be a community of amateurs working together in perfect harmony to reach the chapter's goal and objectives, be those goals social or technical or some of both. Everyone must be in top condition intellectually. Everyone must be willing and able to make a commitment to the chapter's future. Not all have to have advanced degrees in electronics, nor do they all have to have been amateur extra licensees for the past 25 years, but all do have to agree that the ongoing maintenance of the chapter is worth striving and working for. And here's where the leadership of every chapter chimes in. In contrast to the lithe, physically strong and fully muscled crew of oarsmen, the coxswain can be short and small and physically no match to the crew. Last year's 2008 coxswain for the Cambridge rowing team was Miss Rebecca Doe Biggin, a PhD candidate in Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic languages, who tipped the scales at only 102 pounds and stands only 5 feet 4 inches tall. Rebecca makes no meaningful physical contribution to getting her team through the water, but that is not her job. Her job is to coordinate, by voice, the eight strong men she faces, whose backs are to the finish line, and who cannot see where their boat is headed without Rebecca to guide them forward. It is Rebecca who adjusts, through her control of the boat's rudder, the best path, so as to benefit from the ebb and flow of the river, the winds and the current they face as a team. It is through the coordination of the boat's coxswain leader that the oars all enter the water at precisely the same moment and same angle and move through the strokes of each oarsman and then emerge exactly together. The coxswain cannot win without the oarsman, and the oarsman cannot win without the expertise of the coxswain. Mutual trust and respect is the secret to winning the race. QCWA chapter leadership has much in common with the role of the rowing coxswain. Leadership that moves chapters forward must coordinate and synchronize the work of the members, the team, so that all pull together at the same time. Not all can be oarsmen, since not all are physically able, but there is room for the 100-pound weakling, if capable and able to step up and steer the boat. Everyone has a place to contribute and a role to fulfill. Every QCWA chapter needs one or more who will shout encouragement, someone who can see ahead to the finish line and avoid the flotsam that might impede forward speed, someone who can keep the oarsmen on task, working together as a team to overcome the headwinds, direct the team forward, and advance the goals and operating objectives of the chapter. Thus, Every QCWA chapter can use the skills and persuasive abilities of those who have the trust and respect of the team and who trusts and respects them as well to create the kind of winning community that can give their all to the winning end ahead. In sight. The Quarter Century Wireless Association has a place for every member, and every member has a place in the QCWA, which is why we are the elite, the proud, and the many, the QCWA. That's it for this time. 73 DeWall, D.E., Allen, KJ9N. The author, Allen Pickering, can be reached at the following, all lowercase. I'll spell it out. Allen.Pickering@earthlink.net. Again, Allen.Pickering@earthlink.net. Well, it comes time now, folks, to bring a little bit of the YL flavor back into the readings. You're reading World Radio Magazine online for July 2009, here on the Courage Handy Hemp System. Let's look at the YL column. That's the Young Ladies in Amateur Radio. The author is Cheryl Muir, M-U-H-R. Cheryl's call is N0WBV, November 0, Whiskey Bravo Victor. This piece is titled Black Hole or Conditions? It can be a challenge to operate from my shack in Colorado, whether I'm using a dipole or a vertical and a barefoot, or with beams and an amplifier. Colorado often seems to be in a black hole. However, conditions can change at the slightest whim of the radio gods. I try to get on the YL net Thursday nights. It is at 100 UTC and currently meeting between 7.240 and 7.245 megahertz. As summer progresses, it will alternate between 20 meters and 40 meters in the general portions of the band to try and include as many YLs as possible. You don't have HF privileges? Don't worry. Some YLs have the help of a third-party control op, so they can join in the fun. Well, on Thursday nights, either I can get in just fine with a booming signal barefoot, or no one seems to be able to hear me. I am almost never able to talk to Texas, but the other day it was a solid 5-9. I often have a pipeline into Arizona and New Mexico, so I can't complain. I'm not the only one who wonders if it is location or condition. Val Lemko, VE5ACJ, lives in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. She writes that she seems to be in a deep, dark hole this year, and propagation is the pits. We run a 75-meter loop transmatched to all frequencies, and usually it is very good. But the past couple of years, nope, no way. I used to do net control for the Aurora net, 7.055 at 2330 Zulu, but had to give it up because I really wasn't calling. I turned control over to relays in British Columbia, and they were only at an S2 level. They were copying all the stations, but I couldn't hear anyone. The expeditions are great fun and lots of people to work YLs. Apparently, the all-YL trip to the Falkland Islands is no exception. Jeannie Parker, WA6UVF, helped the YLs compile this report. This is devoted entirely to a recent YL operating event because we all must celebrate when active YLs represent us internationally by planning and operating amateur radio activities. Recognition of YL operating activity becomes visible when the majority of the amateur radio populace acknowledges a YL's only operating event is very successful. So kudos from all of us who celebrate the excellent publicity VP8 YL event has furnished for all YLs. Within a small arena of YL operating events, the Victor Papa 8 YL Falkland Islands event January 17 through 31, 2009 certainly proved to be a memorable experience. Six DXYLs traveled great distances from all over the globe to participate using their newly acquired Victor Papa 8 call signs in two operating sites. DXYLs for this event were Liz, Uni, Nikki, Victoria, Chantel, and Ruth. And Janet, VP8AIB, and other local VP8YLs who filled in the schedule when needed. Activities like this require much planning, and this one was no exception, as almost a year was needed to prepare. Janet and Earl M. Bob were the planning hosts. Antennas and operating shacks were furnished thanks to Janet and Bob. They are both seasoned operators with many DX contacts every day, but were extremely happy to welcome DXYLs to operate from their own shacks. The travel planning included packing personal radios, cables, and microphones in addition to materials needed to log either by hand or computer. The logistics of air travel planning, along with needed hand-carried equipment in accordance with current airline security information, are some of the basic obstacles to research far in advance. Some of the VP8YL event operators had not experienced the thrill of working the world and were fortunate to have experienced operators lend the needed skills to operate and log as accomplished YL operators. Reports from stations contacted reflected excellent operating techniques. Those of us who have worked pileups know that this is not easily done, especially when you have 1,000-plus all calling at once. Of course, we acknowledge the YL voice always has priority. The total stations worked reached over 25,000 within 2 weeks, which included several travel, arrival, and departure days. During this time, all countries on all continents and in every amateur zone in the world were contacted. Local VP8YLs filled in the schedule when needed, and especially when the DXYLs did sightseeing, as VP8 has much history to experience. Reports from the girls reflected much joy in operating, but most of all in meeting other DXYLs and visiting another country. And of course, they all can relive VP8 while sending out all those 25,000 QSL cards. According to Janet and Bob, it all began with just an idea and blossomed from there. Hopefully, this will give some of you the spark of expanding an idea into an all-YL event. Congratulations to all the YLs who participated. I didn't work all the YLs there, but did manage to work a few of both the DX and the local VP3 call signs. What a great way to work on your DXYL award. Just work 25 different YLs from outside your own country. There are a number of YL-based awards that the OMs can earn as well, including this one. I only need to get that one last contact for my 2009 YL Friendship Award and 6 more ladies to confirm. I have worked them for my YL Century Club Award. Remember, ladies, if you get an SASE, it means the person you work really wants your QSL card. So what's next? In upcoming columns, I will be writing about YL happenings from the Dayton Hamvention Field Day and the Rocky Mountain region's annual ARRL convention, HamCon Colorado. But don't forget, I need to hear from you. Now, folks, if you want to contact Cheryl Muir and Zero WBV, you can send it to her email, all lowercase, her call sign, and Zero WBV at earthlink.net. Well, we'll go now to MCOM and you. A title, Think Young, to Get Kids Involved in Ham Radio. The author, Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR, Whiskey 7, Sierra Alpha Romeo. I enjoy riding a local bus transportation system and using a light rail system. It saves time and money, and it sometimes provides entertainment or food for thought. Yesterday, there were 3 young men riding on the train, and I couldn't help but overhear the conversation about going tagging later that night. Graffiti has become a challenge and expense for most of our communities, but it was with some interest that I listened in on the conversations of these kids, aged 13 or 14. What caught my attention was a sketchbook where the 3 had tested their designs. Some were in color, and others just black and white. The artist member of the group was telling the other 2 what colors they'd need, and they were debating the best ways to obtain paint and how much time they'd need to complete the task. I don't need to relate additional details I overheard, but I'll share my concerns that 3 young men were not in school on a school day, and their apparent hobby was damaging property by putting graffiti on a wall that they would choose because of high visibility. I reflected to a time when I was that age and thought about what I would have discussed with two friends. It might have been a scout trip or a TV show, or maybe an upcoming school dance. We might have talked about being in a chess club at school or even going to a movie. My friends and I were geeky nerds, and we might have discussed our interest in making a reel-to-reel tape recording of a local neighborhood band, or we might have discussed building of a Heat Kid CB radio. Today's kids face a lot of competition for their time, and certainly times have changed. It's no longer easy for a group of kids to band together as a patrol and just go camping and plinking with their BB guns. TV shows don't seem to garner much interest, and there is little by way of communication. For example, building things they can do. Many schools choose not to have after-school clubs. The lure of things we used to do as kids don't attract attention. I've taken my ham radio station to schools and other youth groups. It might get a few kids to ask questions, but most of the time I'm told it's easier to use the internet or that they cannot put up an antenna in their apartment. While I don't have any solid answers, it doesn't mean I just give up, and neither should you and your radio group. We need to do everything we can to attract youth to our hobby and involve them in a rewarding effort of public service. When you're asked to talk about ham radio at a local school, during a neighborhood fair, or an emergency preparedness event, do all you can to participate. A few months ago, QSD Magazine contained an editorial concerning agencies around the U.S. encouraging their employees to obtain amateur radio licenses so they could operate in times of emergency. The editorial focused on keeping amateur a focus of the license. A friend of mine just completed the licensing process and mentioned his boss had asked him to get a license so their agency would have a ham on board. He's a younger fellow and remarked that he had no problem studying and passing the test, yet he had very little interest in the hobby. He told me that this was his way to look better to his boss and perhaps keep his job. I asked him why their agency hadn't looked to a local ARIS group or ham club to work with in case of an emergency. His answer was pretty pointed. He said there were not enough ARIS members available for his agency, which is an agency less exciting than a fire department or the police department. Little interest was evident when they tried to initiate contact with a local ham club. With this in mind, I contacted a number of local agencies and asked if I could talk about their need for volunteers in general and asked them to tell me what they expect of a volunteer. I was honest and said I was an amateur radio operator and was asking with that specialty in mind. What I found was surprising. I was told that having a ham radio license wasn't the primary talent an agency would look for. I was told that equipment wasn't too important either, as an agency budget that included $1,500 for radios could certainly cover a $500 ham radio. What they wanted were volunteers they could trust, for example, respect confidences, and could work as part of a team. A volunteer must pass a background check and be physically fit. All of the agencies recognize that use of volunteers is a wise thing. It builds community strength and offers ways to stretch tax-funded budgets and even brings diverse talents and experience to the agency. I was surprised when the agency said they wanted volunteer loyalty. In other words, they wanted their volunteers to focus primarily on one agency and not wear too many hats. This got me to thinking to when we held a Red Cross credentialing class for radio people. When word got out that this one-night class would get you a Red Cross ID card, attendance soared. In fact, it was one of the largest meetings we have ever had. The local Red Cross chapter issued dozens of ID cards. Yesterday, I asked a Red Cross radio guy about this class, and he remarked that only one or two of those who attended the class have ever responded or maintained contact with the Red Cross. He and I ruminated that most of the attendees were just collecting ID cards and credentials, which many of us do, perhaps thinking that we can get involved in more events by having more ID cards. But here's the rub. If you're affiliated with too many groups, you don't get the training and the benefit of being part of a single team. In fact, you may be hurting your local group by not being loyal and being a strong team member two of the most mentioned criteria for an agency volunteer. I find myself in a situation often as I am in one meeting or another and miss the local ARIS training net, making the excuse that I'm experienced so I didn't need to participate. What it really tells the group is that I'm a poor candidate to be part of a response team and that I have no time to keep my skills sharp and hear the current training. My priority isn't with one group. It's with trying to juggle involvement with many groups. What if we shifted our thinking? Instead of joining every group, perhaps we should focus on forming relationships with one agency or group so our single credential would be recognized as being of value. Then, if one group needed help, they would just ask for help, and other groups could respond as requested. An agency expects you to be completely familiar with your own radio equipment and be able to send and receive messages with exacting precision. We no longer have the luxury of debating whether Morse code is better than voice or whether VHF is better than UHF. An agency really doesn't care as long as you fit the niche they want you to fill. They want to have your loyalty and want to trust you. They want you to be part of their team and not be a maverick. Emergency communications groups are nearing the time when they need to carefully screen their members. They won't consider the amateur radio license as the complete qualification, but as the initial consideration. Until next month, best wishes from Salt Lake City. Folks, if you want to contact Jerry Wellman, call W7SAR. You can email him at lowercase, two initials, jw@desnews.com. jw@desnews.com. Well, as we wind up for the July 2009 reading of World Radio Online, let's take a look at Hamfest and special events as time allows. In Iowa, the 40th annual anniversary of the Winnebago Itasca Travelers Ham Club is July 18th through July 19th, Forest City, Iowa. Kentucky, River City's Amateur Radio Association Family Fun Time for All, July the 4th, Central Park, Ashland, Kentucky. Oklahoma, 34th Annual Ham Holiday 2009, July the 24th, at the Moore Norman South Penn Conference Center. Pennsylvania, W3UU EPA Convention will be held July 4th at Emmerich Seibert Park in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. South Dakota, Duell County Amateur Radio Club Hamfest is July the 25th, City Park, North Highway 15, Clear Lake, South Dakota. And in Wisconsin, SWAPFest 09, the South Milwaukee Amateur Radio Club's 41st annual, July 11th, at the American Legion Post, South Shepherd Avenue, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Let's look a little ahead to August in Colorado. Denver Radio Club Hamfest is August the 16th, Jefferson County Fairgrounds in Golden, Colorado. State of Ohio, the 18th Annual Columbus Hamfest, August the 1st, at Aladdin Shrine Center, Columbus, Ohio. State of Vermont, the West River Radio Club Special Event Station, August 1st, to celebrate Grace Cottage Hospital Fair Day. They'll be on frequency 14.250 megahertz and 14.070 megahertz from 1400 Zulu to 1800 Zulu with a call sign W1RRC, Whiskey 1, Romeo, Romeo, Charlie. That's the West River Radio Club in Grace Cottage Hospital Fair Day Operations in North Brattleboro, Vermont. Well, folks, this just about winds me up for July 2009's reading of World Radio Online. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512. Or the email address, handyham@courage.org. Handyham is always in lowercase, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham@courage.org. Website, www.handyham.org. Well, this is Bob Zadum, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks a lot for listening along with me again, here on the Courage Handy Ham System, 73.